Okay, well, thank you everybody for coming out tonight to this, the London launch of the Book of Gaza. My name's Rob Page, I'm one of the editors at Comma Press, which is a Manchester-based short story publishing house. We were hoping to have two readers tonight, Atef Abu Saif and Abdullah Taye, and we'll talk a little bit later on about why Abdullah Taye wasn't able to come, but I do apologise for that. It's another issue with the visa and the borders. I have a few thank yous that I need to make. First of all, I need to thank first and foremost English Pen, who have supported this book in lots of different ways, both in terms of the translation costs and the tour costs. Atef is here for four events around England and Wales, and we wouldn't be able to do it without English Pen's support. As the text says, English Pen supports writers who are restricted in their freedoms and their liberties and their ability to publish or see their work published around the world, and also restricted in terms of their movement. And I also need to thank the Arts Council of England, which supports everything that Comma does. And in particular, I'd like to thank the Catan Foundation. Not only for putting on this fantastic event in the Mosaic Rooms, but also for helping Atef out with a last-minute emergency, because he had to come to England via a very circuitous route, and if it wasn't for Omar and the Catan Foundation support, he wouldn't be here either. The way that we're going to do today's event, I'm going to sort of ask Atef to talk a little bit about the book and about writing in Palestine.
You were asking me for the last days.
Sorry?
You were asking me for the last days.
I'm going to ask some more. just a little bit about the history and the development of literature in Gaza in particular. And then Atef's going to read a short excerpt from his story in Arabic, and the English translation will be scrolled down here with the help of Inas. And there's also a short recording which Abdullah has made because he wasn't able to be here, and then we'll have some more questions for me, but I hope you guys join in and ask some questions. As I say, this is the launch of the Book of Gaza, which has been edited by Atef, and he's also contributed a short story to it. I was really struck. I thought I'd start by just asking you about this little footnote, or this little point that you make in your introduction, in which you say that Gaza became known in the wider Palestinian literary world as the producer of oranges and short stories. So I thought I'd just ask you, why is this short story so important to Gaza and Gaza writers?
Actually, I want to thank the Catan, because whenever I'm in Catan, I feel at home, either in Gaza or Ramallah, or here in London the first time. So, thank you very much. One of the things about Palestinian literature, mainly in Gaza, was that after 1967 war, most of the writers from in Gaza, and in West Bank as well, actually, they left the newly occupied territories. From Gaza, we have Mu'in Bshir, the great poets, and Ahmed Omar Shaheen, our novelist, and as well Haroun Hashim Rashid, the great poet, who wrote lots of our national songs, and Abu Sadiq al Husseini, and all those great poets and writers, they left Gaza. And so there were no writers in Gaza at that time. So most of them, they were placed in Cairo, because Gaza is very close to and was under Egyptian control as of 1948. So after that, what the Gazans started to write was short story, actually. In the early 70s, where we're including three of the first generations of the writers of short stories, because short story was very short. So they can handle it, and they could smuggle it to Jerusalem, where publishing was, actually, the newspaper, Al-Fajr, Al-Nahar, Al-Bayadir, all those outlets, which had an Al-Katib, the Katib journal. So the short story was fitting the purpose of writing at that time. Because there were no printing in Gaza, so they couldn't write novels, for example, 300-400 pages. Because if they write 300-400 pages, they will have difficulty sending them to Beirut or to where PLO was based at that time, or to Jerusalem to get it printed. So in this sense, most of the Gazans started to write short stories, actually. Until recently, until mid-80s, the same writers just started to write novels. Even their novels, they were very, very, very short novels, novellas. Most of them, they were 70 pages, 80 pages maximum. Abdullah's novel, for example, Al-Araba Al-Husan, was 75 pages, The Horse and the Carrot. So most of their novels were very short, because they were, and even some writers, they were changing their names, actually. Like the writer we include in the book, Gharib Asqalani, his name is not Gharib, his name is Ibrahim Azzan, but he has to change his name because he was teaching in a government school administrated by the Israeli Authority. So in this sense, much of the Palestinian short story at that time, the 70s, mid-80s, was coming from Gaza. Of course, the Jaffa orange is better than the Gazan orange, 100%. But they were saying Gaza exporting orange because Jaffa were lost in 1948. So the only Palestinian orange was coming from Gaza. And short story. No, Jericho letter, believe me.
And you actually said to me last night that Arafat was taking some short stories and he was photocopying
them. Most of those writings in the 70s, actually they were distributed sometimes to the fighters' mukhayyamats, or camps, or cells. Lots of the meanings and themes of those short stories at that time were to provoke national feeling and steadfastness, as you write in Gharib Asqalani and Zaki Leila, where the description of the miserable life in the camp, and etc. So many of this literature was taken to tell the that how the people in the occupied territory are living in this sense.
The book brings together three generations of writers. You talked about Zaki Leila and Gharib Asqalani, and then there's your generation and Talal Abu Sharwish, and then there's a third generation of young 20-something writers. Mm-hmm. How would you characterize, because you talk a little bit about it in the introduction, the differences between those generations and their approaches?
Yeah, it's hard in a span of 40 or 50 years to talk about generations, but at least sometimes when you introduce something, you need to classify it. And to be loyal to the development of literature, as we were talking with Jihan before, you have to present the development of the literature itself. So we had sub-generation, let's call them, or generations. So those people who wrote in the 70s and early 80s, like Gharib Asqalani, Abdullah Tayyip, the person who couldn't come, the writer who couldn't come due to the closure of the Rafah border, and Zaki Leila, the late, who passed 7 years ago, I think, or 6 years ago. And then my generation, in this sense, we started to write in the 90s, so we were kind of in limbo between the occupation era and the PNA era, or the Palestinian Authority time and the occupation time. So we had experience from this occupation, being like boys of stones, as they would say, Atfal Ajara, throwing stones or whatever. And this includes myself, Talal Abu Sharwish, and Yusra Al-Khatib, one of the female authors. Then we have the youngest generation. Amazingly, all of them are women. So. And we didn't make it, actually. I remember when I wanted to pick up the writers, I just looked at 18 authors. Okay, I know most of them. I know their experience and I know their writings. But sometimes you have to do something for this book. So I was reading the most suitable for this book, and we come up with 5 women authors, actually. And this is, you don't find in most of Arabic literature writings.
That's true.
Yeah.
So it's 50% of the book.
50% of the book for women. And believe me, of the strongest stories are written by women in the book. So, classically, we're very proud as Palestinians of our women participation, or national struggle, or in writings. We have Fadwa Tukan, our greatest poet since the 40s, Fadwa. And she was one, one of our icons of literature is a woman, Fadl Tuqan. So Palestinian woman is always contributing to the to this stream of creating our culture, beside creating our national identity through struggle against the occupation. Layla Khaled, Dalal Mughrabi, all those heroes. But it came by chance, actually, we didn't mean it when we had five women writers. So sometimes when you choose, you have to do kind of a classifications, like generations, and you have to mind, you know, themes sometimes. Because we didn't want that all the themes of the story are the stories are talking about the same subject. However, if you look to how Palestinian literature developed, you see kind of shift in the interest. Like most of the literature written in the 70s in Gaza, let's say in West Bank, and until the first intifada or until the end of the first intifada was more allegoric. Yani you don't find this the place. It's always the refugee camp there. Yani there is no feature for the place. You don't say this is street here and the, because what matters is the topic itself. That you want to narrate the suffering of the people. There are no characters. Yani the characters are not from flesh and blood. Yani they are categories of in the society. They are not by themselves characters. I think at that time this was possible because as I told you, writing was not a pleasure. It was kind of sacrifice at that time. So when you do it, you have to do it in a mission. And this is another question. What is the role of literature in the society? Why do we write? You know? And everybody might... There might be individual reason behind every writer. But at the end, there is kind of public consciousness about writing itself and the role of writing. And I think in the Palestinian context, it has. We had this, and we can talk about it later. But I mean, so this is Yusuf, my friend. So the second generation literature became more. The space took shape, and the characters they became more vivid. You find them in the street. So and here we have a longer novel, by the way, and. Just look to the novels which were written after 1995 or 5. You have the Palestinian novel becoming more longer, more solid, you know, more play-space. You find the streets of Gaza, Al-Karawan, Al-Mukhtar, all those streets, the buildings, you find them in the novels and the stories. And this is very important because fiction, I believe, needs time for stability. While poetry is written for outrage, for anger. So for this, we had the greatest poets during the revolution. Mahmoud Darwish, Samih al-Qasim, Harun Hashim Rashid, Mu'in al-Fsaisu, all those great poets. Because we needed poetry at that time. We need somebody to tell us, سجل أنا عربي ورقم بطاقتي 50,000. Mahmoud Darwish's first great poem, which is every Palestinian remember by heart. This doesn't undermine their talent. They're great poets. But they realized that the role of literature at this era was to do this. However, as West Bank and Gaza were under occupation at that time, we didn't have much novels. Even when the novels started to come up in late 80s, let's say, and later, early 80s up, they were very short, as we said, and they were just short stories, long short stories. Khalas?
Yeah. there's so many things I want to pick out of that. The first thing, you talked about the importance of women figures in terms of the iconography of the Palestinian revolutionary movement, Leila Khaled. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about the culture and tradition of storytelling in Palestinian culture and in Gazan writing. You talked about your own grandmother being the greatest novelist in UD.
That was lying. No.
But effectively, the greatest storyteller in your life.
Yeah, the greatest story was my grandma, Aisha. She would tell you like 5-6 hours on a story without being bored. Wow. Yeah, and actually, I started to write because I wanted to be loyal to her narration. I'm a failure student of her, definitely. And I'm not sure if I can be loyal to this sadness in her stories about Jaffa, her youth, as she will call it, her lost youth in Jaffa. Because as she was grown up and married and got 3 kids, then she has to leave Jaffa to live in the sand of Gaza, in the sands, in the tin. And anyway, she was very talented in telling all this sorrow, all this sadness, all the joy and happiness she had in her youth back home before she was exiled or forced to leave. So, and at the same time, this is where I learned my first narration skills, let's say. And from my neighbors in the refugee, I grew up in a refugee camp, Jabalia refugee camp. And most of the people at that time, in the early 70s, when I was a kid at that time, they had fresh memories about their being working in Jaffa Seaport, for example, Mina Jaffa, or about their orange orchards, or shops in the Iskandar Awada Street, and old Jaffa City. So they were always telling those stories. And sometimes, and this is once again the same question, why do we write, and the role of literature in our life? And sometimes I felt that I got my education and my skills to write. So I want to convey, not the same stories, because I don't want to be Aisha, my mother. Because she's the greatest novelist, but she's not a novelist. But she has this spirit which makes her the greatest narrator ever you can meet. So I don't want to repeat the stories, and I don't want to tell their own stories, but I want to convey all this sense. And I think sometimes you have, as I told you before, you need to have a motivation. Why should you write? And always I believe there is a role for literature. I remember when I was in the first intifada in Israeli jail, as most of my generation was, and it was Ramadan, I think. It was not long Ramadan, summer. It was in the winter, I think, 1991. So I was in charge of cultural activities. I was 19 years old, and there's a student, etc.
This is in the Negev Desert.
Yeah, Negev Desert. Kitzaut, they call it. So I was in charge of the cultural activities. So it was Ramadan, so I went to make them like a magazine, and we hang in the tent, you know. So I wrote this story. I remember I spent like 2 days writing it. And the whole story describes the feeling of a mother when she's preparing her day to welcome her released son. He was supposed to be released today. So I'm like in, let's say, 10 pages, I'm describing how she cleaned the house 15 times, not one time, because she wants to make sure it's clean. How she went to the market 3 times because, he might like a chicken. No, he might like meat. He might... She does everything. Then at the end, of course, he's released. While she's hugging him, somebody is telling her, wow, the other son was captured now. So anyway, this was my story. I still have it, by the way. I didn't publish it. But I remember the comment of one of the prisoners, which was, I think, the best lesson I took ever in my life in literature. So I'm not going to say it in Arabic anyway, because in a very Gazan dialect, Gaza City dialect, I was saying, oh wow, Shakhar Yusuf, and Shakhar lo Shakhra, Starf Shakhra al Ghazawi, Hadatuk Barak. Anyway, so in a very Gazan dialect, he was saying, oh, you're wasting my time to tell me that somebody was released and others was imprisoned. And this was in front of 100 prisoners, and I was showing off as a writer, you know. And I'm somebody who writes, and then it turned out what he wants to say is that literature cannot just tell me that life doesn't matter, that somebody is getting off prison, getting released, and somebody in prison. He wants to tell me that when I read, I need to know something for the future. It's not that you're not going to disable my capacity to imagine a better future. And I think this is one of the roles of literature, of writings. If I want to repeat the stories of those people in the refugee camp where I grew, and this sorrow, and I'm loyal to their memories, I'm loyal to this sorrow, to their unfulfilled dreams, to their broken, beautiful images in the past. But at the same time, I want to make out of this something which can survive. Which, if they're grandkids, someday they read it, they can feel the same feeling that I felt when I was sitting with my grandmom Aisha.
Thank you. I think that might be a nice moment for you to read a little bit of a story which shows some of that hope. Do you want to read just the opening?
اقعد على اقعد
زي ما بدك.
لا
توقف الاطفال
ما سيئا، بس هيك قاعد بحس حالي زي البرق القرآن
يعني صح.
لا بس عن جد بعد قاعد هيك بعدين بسأل زي المقرى ان شاء الله انا الرحلة في الطريق المعاكس. لم يكن بمقدور إله الصدف أن يعتني بهذه الطريقة الفائقة في ترتيب لقائهم بلا موعد وبلا اتفاق أمام كراج السيارات في منتصف مدينة رفع. الشمس تنسل بخفة في عمق الشارع المتجه غربا من منتصف الميدان الذي يتوسط المدينة الحدودية. أقنية الموز على نقيض البلع معلقة أمام محل الفواكه الضخم على ناصية الميدان مثل فرص ضائعة. سيارات الأجرة المرسيدس والهونداي تصطف تحت المظلة العالية تنتظر ركاب ذاهبين شمالا حيث لا جنوب بعد رفع إلا العبور لمصر. خمسة سائقين في انتظار امتلاء سياراتهم. في مثل هذه الأوقات في آخر النهار تخف الحركة ويقل الركاب، إذ أن الحركة تصبح عكسية حيث معظم الركاب يعودون من أعمالهم وزياراتهم في غزة. مجموعة من الركاب يجلسون على كراسي بلاستيكية في المقهى الصغير تحت المظلة خلف السيارات يرتشفون لينسون الدافئ. ارتفع صوتهم قليلا وهم يتجادلون في قضية بدت مملة لصاحب المقهى الصغير. فرك عقاب سيجارته بقدميه وهو ينفث آخر ما تبقى في فمه من دخانها سحبا على شاربه الكث شديد السواد إلا من رشقات الدخان النافذة خلاله. سياسي أنا الحكيم. كان مقهو عبارة عن كشك خشبي صغير ممتلئ بالنراجيل والسجائر وثلاجة صغيرة تمتلئ بالمشروبات الغازية والعصائر. لم يكن هناك مساحة تكفي لشيء من الجسد المندس أن يقوم بأعماله داخله، مثل أن يغلي المشاريب على جرة الغاز الصغيرة الموضوعة جانبا بجوار الثلاجة، أو يعد النرجيلة ثم يخرج ليتوج رأس التبر بالفحمات الملتهبة في كانون نار حديدي موضوع بجوار الكشك. ألسنة النيران المتصاعدة من الكانون كأنها أياد تشير للمسافر تدعوه أن يرتاح قليلا في هذا المقهى الدافئ قبل أن يواصل سفره الذي لا يزيد عن 40 كيلومترا، لكنه السفر الأطول لأي ساكن في قطاع غزة، حيث أن هذه أطول مسافة على طول الشريط الساحلي الذي تشكل مدينة رفع قاعه. يضع النرجيلة أمام أحد الزبائن ثم يمسح وجه الطاولات الصغيرة المصروفة بعناية حول الكشك الخشبي وبين ممرات السيارات الواقفة مثل الأصنام تحت المظلة. محلات الآلات الكهربية، مطعم الشاورما والكافتير الجديد الضخم مقابل الكراج، كل شيء بدا هادئا إلا من تلك الجلبة التي أثارها توقف باص الجامعة تنزل منه الفتيات القادمات من نهار دراسي طويل في جامعتهن في غزة. ثم خفت كل شيء، ريح خفيفة تحمل بعض الأتربة ولسعات حارة مشبعة برائحة الصحراء التي ترتدي مباشرة خلف أسلاك الحدود في الجنوب. كل شيء يقترح أنها نهاية نهار متعب للجميع. أوقف رمزي سيارته الصغيرة الزرقاء من محل الشاورما قاطع عن الطريق على المغنية في جهاز التسجيل أن تكمل الكوبليه الأول من أغنية حزينة. صار باتجاه المقهى الصغير سحب كرسيا وحط تعبا عليه. إحدى سيارات الهونداي امتلأت مما أدخل السعادة على وجه سائقها الذي انتظر أكثر من ساعة ينادي على مسافرين متجهين شمالا إلى غزة. لا شيء أكثر عمقا من حدس صاحب المقهى وفراسته يجعله يحضر نرجيلة لرمزي دون أن يسأله. يمكن لجالس على طاولة أخرى أن يظن أن رمزي زبون دائم في المقهى. رمق رمزي صاحب المقهى بنظرة حملت الشكر. هز الرجل رأسه وهو يشعل سجارة وقال بصوت خافت قهوة، فرد عليه رمزي أعشاب. سحب نفسا عميقا كأنه يعب من عمق الجان نرجيلة الراحة والهدوء الذي افتقدهما طوال هذا النهار الشاهد مثل وجهه الآن. جاء صاحب المقهى بكأس الأعشاب، حبات السكر تنتشر على حواف الكأس. جلس رجلان كهلان على الطاولة المجاورة، كانت رائحة التبغ تفوح من سحب الدخان الخارج من فمه، تسافر حوله مثل أفكار بعيدة إلى نقطة الحدود حيث أمضى نهاره منذ ساعات الصباح الأولى حتى آخر ساعات النهار في انتظار أخيه الذي لم يره منذ 20 عاما. كانت تلك سنوات أخرى من الفراق قطعتها مكالمة أخيه المفاجئة أنه قادم أخيرا إلى غزة. لم يعد يحتمل الغربة بعيدا. رفع كأس الأعشاب إلى فمه وما كاد ينتهي من رشفته الأولى حتى تلاقت عيناه بعيني سمير يخطو باتجاهه. سحب كرسيا وجلس. المرة الأخيرة التي التقي فيها كانت على مقاعد الدراسة في الجامعة.
كندا قبل 10 سنين يومها قدم الامتحان الأخير بك الإجماع وخرج من قاعدة الامتحانات الضخمة في مبنى جامعة الأزهر القديم بغزة. جلس على المقاعد الحجرية في الحديقة التي تمتد بجوار الجامعة يتحدثان عن أحلام مرجوة وحياة مشتهاة وأمالا قال إنهما سينذران حياتهما بحثا عنها. كانت السيارات تمر مسرعة من أمام الحديقة قاطعة إشارة الضوئية الحمراء لتفسح المجال للمسيرة الغاضبة التي كانت تنطلق تحمل جثمان أحد الشهداء من مستشفى الشفاء إلى منزله في حي الرمال. كانت الأصوات غاضبة والساسة يسيرون في المسيرة محاطين بالحراسات والكاميرات والصحافة والنسوة في آخر المسيرة يندبن الشاب الطيب الذي خطفه الموت. قام ولحق بالمسيرة ثم تفرق ولم يلتقي بعدها. فجأة قفزت تلك اللحظات فوق الطاولة الخشبية أمامهما الآن حيث الأحلام التي لم يتحقق جزء منها والحياة التي ما زال يتسلقان شجرتها لم يقطف الكثير من ثمارها بعد. كأساء الأعشاب تبعهما في الجناة قهوة والحديث جرى حديث أخرى عن الأحلام والحياة والخطط، لكن هذه المرة كان للخيبات والانكسارات والثمار التي لم تقطف نصيب أكبر مما كانت عليه قبل 10 سنين حيث كانت المسيرة الغاضبة تندفع في شوارع المدينة تحمل الشاب الطيب وحيث كانت زهرة الشباب تتفتح تنشر عبقها في عيونهما فتلمع مثل جمل يتقد فوق رأس النرجيلة وهو يعب التبغى وينشر سحب الدخان حول رأسيهما. كان على سبيل أن يعود إلى غزة بعد 10 سنوات في الغربة من بر بين غزة أحلى، قال وهو يمسح حبات السكر عن حواف الكأس لأصابعه ثم يلعقهما فيما عيناه تزومان في المكان. السنون تمضي بسهولة مثل سحب الدخان المندمجة مع نسمات الصحراء الساخنة التي تهب بين فينة أخرى من الجنوب. خرج العمل محاسبا في شركة استثمارات في دبي. في البداية ضحكت له الدنيا حيث وجد في عمله الجديد مصدر للدخل الوفير الذي استطاع من خلاله تعليم إخوته وبناء بيت العائلة في المخيم وتزويج أخته وشراء قطعة أرض وبناء بيت جميل عليها يطل على البحر. كان كل ذلك تم دون أن يعود إلى غزة. كان يرسل الفلوس لأخيه الذي يتدبر عنه كل شيء. كانت فكرة العودة إلى غزة تصيبه بالصداع زي كل بطلع برا. كانت فكرة العودة إلى غزة تصيبه بالصداع خاصة مع الإغلاق المتكرر للمعبر اليتيم الذي يربط غزة بالعالم الخارجي عبر مصر، الرحلة القاسية التي يكره القيام بها عبر صحراء سيناء، ثم الانتظار لساعات على المعبر قبل الدخول إلى غزة. كان التفكير بالعملية العكسية أكثر قسوة، أي أن يخرج من غزة، فالمسافر يحتاج لأيام ربما لأسابيع من الانتظار على الجانب الفلسطيني من المعبر قبل أن يتمكن من القيام بالمعجزة والخروج من غزة. كان يكتفي بإرسال الفلوس والهدايا والتحيات والأمنيات عبر الهاتف، بيد أن هذا لم يعد يكفي بعد 10 سنين، إذ أن دموع أمه ورجاءاته وتنهداته على الهاتف باتت كلها كابوسا يؤلم نومه. فالمرأة العجوز التي دخلت أكلها الثامن لم يعد لها أمنية إلا أن ترى العائلة تجلس حول طاولة واحدة تتناول العشاء للمرة الأخيرة، أمنية لن تتحقق في الوقت الراهن، إذ أن الابن الأكبر مضى على وجوده في السجن 20 عاما بعد أن فشلت كل اتفاقيات السلام في إخراجه، وبعد أن فشلت كل تظاهرات أمام مقر الصليب الأحمر في شارع الجلاء بغزة كل يوم الاثنين في أن تحرك لتاج الزنزانة عن الولد الذي دخل السجن وهو لم يكمل 20 عاما بعد. قرر ألا يحرمها من الحد الأدنى من تلك الأمنية، أن يعود هو إلى غزة فتلتئم العائلة حتى وإن لم تكن تلك اللمة كاملة. امرأة عجوز خلفها طفلين تشير لبائع الفاكهة أن يقف لها كيلوين من الموز، البائع يمد قلبي موز للطفلين. بدأ الميدان هادئا حيث بدأ الظلام يزحف بخفة يلف مثل ردان أسود يسقط من السماء. الرجل الستيني صاحب المقهى الصغير ينفض الجمرات عن رأس النرجيلة ينفخ فيه فيخرج الدخان المتكدس في داخله ثم يضعه مرة أخرى على النرجيلة ثم يقوم بوضع الجمرات مرة أخرى عليه. ضحك رمزه يقول يعني عمل التورجات. الضحكة شاحبة إذ أن مجرد التفكير في المستقبل يقتل أي لحظة سعادة معابرة. في مرات كثيرة علينا أن نملك الشجاعة لتقبل واقعنا. هز سمير رأسه وهو يرى هذا الواقع يلاحقه وهو لم يزل على أطراف الحدود. أما أخو رمزي فلم يتمكن من العودة عبر المعبر. صار له 3 أيام كل يوم يعود أدراجه للفندق الصغير في مدينة العريش في سيناء للمبيت هناك، ثم في الصباح ينتظر أمام بوابة المعبر من جهة المصرية حيث آلاف المسافرين العائدين لضرورات مختلفة يتزاحمون في المرور من البوابة الحديدية في مشهد سريالي يصيب المرء بالغثيان. عاش ل3 عقود في إيطاليا وقرر أنه تعب من الغربة وأنه يريد العودة لغزة لاستثمار أمواله الكثيرة هناك. تحدث مرة عن إقامة مصنع الأثاث وأخرى عن إنشاء شركة مقاولات والثالثة عن إقامة مول تجاري ضخم في وسط مدينة غزة البلاد ولا بغير أهلها. رمز لا يذكر تحديدا انه راى اخاه الاكبر الذي ترك غزه في اواخر السبعينيات حيث حين كان لم يبلغ سنته الخامسه. التحق بجامعه القاهره ثم سافر لايطاليا لاستكمال دراسته في ميلانو الا انه وجد في قطاع العمل فرصا لا توفرها الدراسه. مات والده ولحقت به والدته ولم ياتي الى غزه مره واحده خلال تلك السنين الطويله. فقط بفضل التكنولوجيا يمكن لرمز ان يتعرف على وجه اخيه عبر الصور او يتحدث معه عبر السكايب. كان يشعر بنشوة انه يراقب اطفال اخيه يكبرون بين صورة واخرى.
Thank you, Atif. As we're talking about the vicissitudes of the Rafah border and the problems of getting out of Gaza, now might be an opportune moment to play the recording which Abdullah Taye has made specially for these readings. It's a very low quality recording. So it's been compressed a lot, so there's a lot of hiss.
Good quality in Gaza.
Maybe it's the way it's been sent. There's a lot of hiss on it, so I do apologise. Abdullah is just going to introduce his story and then talk a little about his story. His story is a very allegorical story, as he explains, and it's a story about a bald man and a guard carrying a box with unknown contents in it.
Good afternoon. Thanks to Kuma Bris, High Festivals, and Liverpool Festivals to invite a Palestinian writer, refugee, who lives in Jabalia Khan in the siege Gaza State. I am 60 years old. I have been writing novels, short stories, and articles since 1975. I have lived all my life in the miserable war camp, and I have never lost the hope being free from occupation. This is the most hard times in Gaza Strip that I have ever lived. I really wanted to be with you enjoying this nice meeting, but the only border between Gaza Strip and the world has been closed for over a month till now. Therefore, I could not travel to be with you today. Although the organizers made a lot of efforts, but it did not work. I did not lose the dream to live in the independent state of Palestine and to be free to travel wherever I want, and to see my family lives a normal life. I am grateful to your attendance and that you will enjoy reading my literary, which was translated by Koma Bris and Adam Tal. My story, The Two Men, is one of allegory literature, moving events, dialogue, monologue, description, symbols, and the language of the story, making sure that the reader all the time thinking that the bald man and security guard had transported a girl against her will in a large cardboard box in the car bay, from a place next to the Gaza beach to the house of the bald man. Events and the language indicated that a crime occurred and that the girl is dead or sleeping under drugs, and the driver notes the confusion of the two men transporting quietly and carefully the cardboard box. He makes sure that time for something expensive is in the box. The security guard remains at the place at the beach. The bald man and the driver traveled to the bald man's house and they put the box in the lobby of the house. The driver leaves the place with doubt. Then the reader surprised when the bold man opens the box and took the delicious ceramic bowl out of the box. He examined its edge and engravings to join it to the his group, which they hide in this house. Story language and handled events treated the transferred object in the box as a human, and the reader took it when he knows at the end that the transferred object is an artifact. What's the link between the artifact and the earth, and between the bowl and his care to collect artifacts and hide it from strangers who want to grab it? He is not a thief because he is the landowner. Did he afraid from a thief stronger than him? What's the relationship between the sea, land, and the climate factors that supported and participated in the action of the two men? The text is full of science. Finally, is the Palestinian writer writes for just the luxury of writing, or he writes about a human being lost freedom and long-awaited rights? Writers say each reading of the text is another vision, and a criticism of the text is another version of the text. From the besieged Gaza, from Jabalia, refugee come, I wish you a good time and successful meeting. Thank you.
Abdullah started that piece by saying he felt it was the worst time he's ever known in Gaza, and yet today is a very auspicious, hopeful day, because today is the day that the new united Palestinian government has been sworn in.
So what has this book?
I was going to ask you. Well, politics, enough of politics, as the cafe owner says. But Atef, I should have said at the beginning, is also a political scientist. He lectures on political science, and you're a political writer and a political journalist. So, putting your writer's hat down just for a moment, do you feel it's an optimistic time? You talked about the need for hope and the need for optimism in writing, but do you feel it's an optimistic time now, or do you agree with Abdullah?
I don't think it. This Palestinian internal division is, of course, we can talk about conspiracy, international intervention. It's easy to throw the burdens on the others, but it is internal Palestinian. We made it as Palestinians with our wrong calculations and selfishness and partisan ambitions, and because so we made this anyway. So I think the only way to end this miserable situation, which was perfect, actually, and during these last 8 years or 7 years, human rights were violated, both in West Bank and Gaza. People were not allowed to travel, etc., and the space for freedom and public opinion sharing or discussion or gatherings was limited. And because we were very much indulged in those details, our struggle against Israel as well suffered from obstacles, problems, and sometimes rhetorical speeches, which doesn't mean anything. So I think as we would say, we survive by hope. And if we, especially we Palestinian, if somebody's not Palestinian, he has to forgive me. With all these obstacles and problems, catastrophe, and Nakba, and all these things we faced since 1917, actually, which is 100 years now, two, 3 years since Balfour Declaration, when the Israeli settlers, Jewish settlers, started to be brought from all over Europe, because Europe wanted to clarify its past, and we have to pay the price. Since that time until now, we're facing problem after a problem. And if we didn't believe me, if Aisha, my grandmom, she didn't have hope, she would die in 1948. But she lived 30 years afterward. Because she was still believing that the future is better, even if the situation is very hard. So, back to the concrete politics. And not imagine politics, I was describing it. Concrete politics. I think this is natural what happened today when the government is sworn and finally we had national unity government, or what they call it, coalition government, whatsoever. And without we Palestinians realize again that our strength is in our unity, and is that we don't need to destroy Israel. We cannot. As Edward Said was saying, our strength is in our weakness. No. Yani, we are the victims of this, and we have to struggle to show the international community that our victimness is a result of their silence. It's not because Israel is so powerful. It's because the international community, which empowers Israel every day, which unfortunately, yani, it's ridiculous when you want a state in the United Nations and they give you incomplete state. And Israel takes a state in your country 6 years ago. And I, for this, I need, there is lots of missions to be done for us Palestinians. And I think we cannot pursue achieving our national goals without being united first. And for this, this is a little step in a long road. It's not a goal in itself. You know, this is something that should be born by nature with us. And the mistake which was done in 2007, I think now we decided that we have to delete it from our mind. But we have to learn how not to repeat the same mistake again in the future. This is politics.
Thank you. One last question. Just, I'm sort of asking the same question in different ways, really. You talked about the fact that you're a teacher, and you teach creative writing as well, and a lot of your students don't have hope. And you were talking about the student who has the...
No, I mean, when you discuss the situation in Gaza, mm-hmm. and I think I see many faces who were in Gaza at certain times, the situation was very hard, yeah.
It is, exactly.
Yani, I remember one of my students, she was a girl, she's from Rafah. And she was, when the discussion, she would be a brilliant political scientist, to be honest. But in the exam, she's like, you know... Nothing. She doesn't study. So I was asking her, why don't... She said, if I get 70 or I get 90, so what is the difference? I will stay in Gaza, I will not pursue my education, I will not find a job. So it's the same if I get 60, 70, 80, 90. And apparently her window, as you were saying, when she opens her windows in the border, for Block Yibna area of Rafah. So when she opens her window, she sees Egypt and... But she never left Gaza in all her life. She was 21st years. So when people lose hope, believe me, they lose the appetite to survive, the appetite to do anything. And here, once again, back to the literature, because I don't want to talk too much politics, you know. Back to literature. Literature can matter in this sense. Yani, it can offer not another reality, can tell them that even this miserable situation is something from which you can create something. And this was the message with my comrade in the prison. He wanted to convey when he wondered, you know, why should you waste my time telling me that somebody was released and others was in prison? And this is why writers, as Abdullah was writing and others before, and my generation and the generation after, pursue this mission, because And one of the main messages in the book, which we missed talking about actually, is that Gaza is not only, we have a journalist, Yusuf, he was one of the greatest journalists in the world, by the way. During 2008 and 2009, he was, during Shirin, he was covering the news in Gaza. He's Palestinian. So, one of the main images about Gaza, it's Gaza is a bakery where news are baked, la, makhbaz, where you have nice pizza news, you know. Nice Warsaw news. It's all the news, you know. Yani either you have reportage, documentary, breaking news. And I studied in Italy personally, I did my master in Bradford. I did my PhD in Italy. So whenever I'm asked about from my friends in Europe, how does it feel to live in Gaza? I would say it's like feeling being a piece of the news. Because it's true. You might walk in the city and suddenly you die. You cannot plan for something. And Ra didn't know that I'm coming until I was in Amman airport, by the way. Because I was not sure that I could make it.
I didn't know you were coming until you were in Heathrow airport.
Yeah. I managed to leave Gaza. I went to Ramallah. I didn't tell them. Because, yeah, I might just, they take me from the checkpoint and retain me. Then I went to Limbe Bridge, King Hussein Bridge. And there I'm not sure. The Israeli soldier might retain me back to Gaza. I crossed to Jordan. Then again, in Jordan, you have to make sure that they didn't doubt you're a terrorist coming to a royal family house, you know, and they send you back from the airport. I'm not kidding. So this feeling of uncertainty, you know, of not predicting the future. And remember, in the first intifada, I suppose I was a good student in this school. At least I did my PhD later on. So I loved the school. So I was doing my homeworks and preparing for the next. Then the worst minute in my life, when the soldier comes, it's exactly in the Fajr prayers time, which is 3 o'clock after midnight, to impose curfew. So all my plans, which I was at that time, 10 years, 15, something in this year, all my plans for tomorrow will collapse while he's saying, the people of Jabalia, it's imposed curfew, and this who breaks the curfew takes responsibility on his life. So this feeling of uncertainty always hunts you, you know, and hunts your ideas and your mind. It makes you live, and as I named my last novel, which is published recently in Amman, 2 weeks ago it appeared, Haya Mu'allaqa, Life on Hang.
Suspended life.
Yeah. You never feel, and I hear this word from my friends, by the way, I didn't make it. Yani, you always postpone and suspend or hang your life because you're not sure that it's going to wear. So once again, here the literature in this little room with all these contradictions has to survive. And I think we wanted to say in this book, Gaza is not only producing news, killing, reportage, documentary. It also produces literature. It has people who love, people who hate, people who have social problems. It's not only national. National is very important. And people at the same time who want their freedom, first and last. But at the same time, I remember when I did my first play, which was shown in Gaza, Mr. Perfect is called. The Israeli newspaper, Haaretz, they made one page reportage about it by an American Jew. He was in Gaza. So, you know, sorry. What the title of the article was, even they have theater in Gaza. We were not supposed to have theater. So I'm not saying even we have short story in Gaza, but I'm saying, yeah, we do have good literature. And we have women writers as well. And we have people who look for the future and people who are sad about the past. But at the end, they are human beings in this. And we wanted, and this is my last sentence, I'm tired from speaking.
Keep going. And don't stop.
We wanted to present another image of Gaza. Thank you very much if we managed to do this. You know?
Thank you.
Thanks.